You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 76. The last show was part two of our Fall Festivals guide. Back in episode 71, my wife Marie and I talked about two dozen events here in New Orleans in September and October. In 75, we covered events in November and December, including the Po' Boy Fest, Boudin Bourbon and Beer, and lots more. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. You'll be planning your next trip to New Orleans in no time. And if you are a New Orleanian, you're sure to find some events that are new to you. Today's show is about Marie Laveau, the famous voodoo priestess. But before we jump into the discussion about Marie Laveau, I want to tell you about our sponsor, the Old 77 Hotel. The Old 77 is a place I've recommended frequently. It's in a great location in the Warehouse District, just 3 blocks from the French Quarter. It's close to lots of great places to eat and drink, and it's near the streetcar lines, too. They have an award-winning restaurant, Compère Le Pen. In fact, Chef Nina Compton recently won a James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Southern United States. The bar is one of my favorite places to meet out-of-town listeners because I know they'll enjoy a great cocktail. Plus, the biscuits are terrific, by the way. I love that they have a wide range of choices when it comes to rooms. They really have something for everyone. Whether it's the studio room with a loft bed, interior rooms for those who don't want any hint of daylight after a long night out, premium rooms and artist loft suites curated by New Orleans artists. Oh, and they're pet friendly, too. The Old 77 is located at 535 Chapatula Street. Use code BBOLD77 when you book a room and save 25%. Plus, you get a little bit of lagniappe, a little something extra, in the form of a $10 credit at Tutla for coffee and such in the morning. Now, let's jump into today's discussion about Marie Laveau. Hey, y'all, this is Mark. I'm back with another episode, and this one, if you have listened to the episode about Madame LaLaurie, this one I am speaking to the same author who wrote a wonderful book about Marie Laveau, and so I'm joined today by Carolyn Morrow Long. Carolyn, welcome back, and thank you for being on the show. So in our last discussion, we talked about the more recent of these two books, which was about Madame LaLaurie and the myth and the legend and the truth about the tragic fire at her place and the slaves that were found in that story. I would encourage people to go listen to that. But along the way, I also found that you had written actually a first book about Marie Laveau, and many both fans and New Orleanians know at least briefly of the story of Marie Laveau, or at least think they know the story of Marie Laveau, often referred to as the Voodoo Queen. And I can't wait to get into the discussion with you because so much of the legend is different and there's somewhere in between about her actual life. And in many respects, her actual life is so much more interesting than some of the myths. So I'm happy to have you back and happy to talk about Marie Laveau today. Again, as you and I were talking off air, there's lots of ways that lives have intersected there. But let's first talk again. Much like Madame LaLaurie, there's some overlap in terms of the time period that Marie Laveau lived. And certainly I want to just kind of familiarize our listeners with New Orleans at the time. So Marie Laveau, the story to me really, as you describe in your book, really starts with probably her grandmother or even earlier.
Well, her great-grandmother, actually.
And so her great-grandmother was... and I don't recall now, was she born in New Orleans or came to New Orleans?
She was an enslaved woman who I'm pretty sure came from Senegal on the last slave ship that the French brought over. She would have been born in Africa, if I'm correct, about 1736. She became the slave of a man named Roche Belair, who was a shoemaker, and she had a daughter named Catherine, and Catherine was not fathered by Mr. Roche, the master. Her father was a black man named Jean Belair, and nobody knows exactly who he was. I don't know if he was an enslaved man, if he might have even been an Indian, who knows. But Catherine was always referred to in official records as, quote, a negress. So she was not mixed race. Catherine had four children, all of whom were classified as mulattoes. So they definitely had a white father. Who was their father? Maybe it was Monsieur Roche. Maybe it was one of her other owners. She went through a number of owners. And Marie's mother, Marguerite, was her second child.
Well, and as you're describing that, it makes me remember that in the book. So growing up in New Orleans, you sort of just are used to the sort of various terms, but you actually have a little definition area mm-hmm. at the start of your book to explain some of what you were just describing and the various, you know, were you born from a free person of color? Were you born from the concubinage of say a person of African descent and a white person or a slave owner? And there's all these variations that in New Orleans are just sort of part of the history. But if you are new or learning about New Orleans, there's a lot of layers there and a lot of differentiations there. How did you become interested in the story of Marie Laveau and her family?
Well, I went to New Orleans for the first time in 1978, and I was staying with a friend on Conti Street, just a few blocks from St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. So I would get up early in the morning and walk over there. And at that time, people were still decorating the tomb. They were still drawing X's on it. They were still leaving offerings. And I saw this three-tiered tomb with all these red X's on it and all these beads and flowers and fruit and coins and who knows what, bottles of liquor and everything in front of it. And I thought, what in the world is this? And, you know, there was a little old man there that I guess was the sexton of the cemetery. And he said, oh, that's Marie Laveau's tomb. And he showed me how to draw the red X with brick. Mm. So I thought, boy, I want to know more about her. And then I tried to find a good book. The only thing I found was Voodoo in New Orleans, mm-hmm. written in 1946 by Robert Talent. Biggest piece of trash. And I read it on the airplane going home. And it's talking about these drunken orgies and the sweating black bodies and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh, my God, there's got to be something better than this. Surely some scholar, some historian, some anthropologist has written something better than this. And I never could find anything. So 17 years later, I said, I'm going to write it myself. And by then, I had kind of discovered how to use the archives in New Orleans, although it takes years to figure it all out, where to go to find what. But I started working on it. And in the meantime, I was working on another book. And my publisher was actually more interested in the other one. So I spent most of my time on that. But on the side, I was still working on Marie. That's what I was really wanting to work on. And then as soon as the first book was published in 2001, I started working on Marie full time.
Well, and one of the things, and maybe I should have started with this, is that Marie Laveau, there is so much legend built up around Marie Laveau that she was this voodoo queen. Maybe she was a voodoo queen for 50 years. Some even say, the tour guides will say 100, 140 years, and we'll talk about that. There's a lot of talk about all the people buried in her tomb and all the works that she is said to or alleged to have done with the prisons and with the church. And you mentioned voodoo and sort of this idea of quote unquote drunken orgies. And yet you dig into it and find in many cases a very different story. And so I think maybe where we should start, you kind of mentioned her family a little bit. And I don't know if we should start there or if we should dive into what voodoo is and how it ties into previous cultures.
Well, we can talk about the family a little bit first. I think she was mostly raised by her grandmother, whose name was Catherine Henry. She was enslaved in the beginning, but she became free. She purchased her own freedom, and she bought a little piece of land on St. Anne Street and had a little cottage built. And I think that's where Marie grew up.
And that's just a couple blocks behind St. Louis Cathedral.
Yes, and it's right across the street practically from Congo Square, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's on St. Anne between Rampart and Burgundy. So Marie was married, legally married, in the church to a free quadroon from Haiti. He was one of the many people who came from what was then the island of Saint-Domingue during and after the Haitian Revolution. So Marie had two children with him, both of whom appear to have died because you never hear anything further about them. Mm. And her husband's name was Jacques Paris, and he died. So then she went for the rest of her life by the name the Widow Paris. And then she began a domestic relationship with a white man named Christophe Glapion, who was a member of a very aristocratic family, the de Glapions, and had seven children with him. And two of them survived to adulthood. Their names were Heloise and Philomene.
Well, and by all accounts, sort of one of the myths or the part of the legend of Marie Laveau is that she perhaps had been a hairdresser. And in your book, you talk about there's no sort of empirical evidence to say that. But as part of the legend, that was sort of her way of getting to know other people in the community, getting to know the upper crust, the elite.
Well, she could very well have been a hairdresser,
sure,
because a lot of free women of color did that work. But you know, her name appears in the city directory practically every year. Never says hairdresser. No profession is given. She also was in the census every 10 years. Never says hairdresser. She's just in there. So I guess they weren't going to put Voodoo Queen in,
right,
in the census.
And as you and I have talked about, the records in New Orleans, going back almost to the beginning of New Orleans, are pretty thorough. There are gaps, but there's lots of information about people.
Yes, especially if somebody was Catholic, and if they were involved in any kind of business transactions at all, you're going to find them. If they were involved in any kind of court cases, you're going to find them. If they got their name in the newspaper, you're going to find them. It's just amazing the stuff you can find out about people.
Yes, the Catholic Church and the Catholic Church in New Orleans are very good record keepers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I wanted to point out as well. As we get into the story of Marie Laveau and we talk about voodoo and that as a religion, it's very intertwined with Catholicism.
Absolutely.
And perhaps people that aren't familiar with New Orleans may not understand. New Orleans is overwhelmingly, even today, Roman Catholic. And at the same time, when you think about, well, how could voodoo and Catholicism interrelate, again, as we'll get into, there's a lot of overlap. So it makes perfect sense that you would have these two things, particularly with the refugees from Haiti and the slaves coming from the Senegalese regions. It all makes sense that they're not so very different and have their roots in similar
well,
origins.
Well, I say they're sister religions, mm, and that voodoo is the only North American Afro-Catholic religion. And it is a religion, and it kind of makes me angry when people won't spell it with an uppercase and they spell it V-O-O-D-O-O, which kind of means a bunch of booga booga to me.
And we should point out your book is called A New Orleans Voodoo Priestess, and you spell voodoo and you explain in the book why V-O-U-D-O-U.
Yes, that was the way it was spelled. That's the French spelling, the way it was spelled in the 19th century. So the Africans, the Senegalese, and the people from that part of West Africa had a religion that meshed very well with the Catholic hierarchy of God the Father and the saints. They had what they called loi, meaning deities, spiritual forces that govern the world. And they had very various attributes. There was there was always a powerful woman figure, a mother figure, and they said, oh, that's the Virgin Mary. And the priests would give them prayer cards to try to convert them. And they would see pictures of the saints, and they'd say, oh, yeah, we know who that is. So it just became, sometimes people use the word syncretized, that it became intertwined. Now, Marie was a very devout Catholic. She was a member of St. Louis Cathedral congregation. She was baptized there. She was married there when she had her first legal marriage to a man of color. All of her children were baptized there. The ones who died young had their funerals there. She went to Mass. I don't know if she went every day, but she went frequently. And when she died, her funeral was held by a priest of the cathedral. She was buried in the Catholic cemetery. So she was a devout Catholic all of her life. She also was carrying on the traditions of her African religion. So to her, I don't think there was any conflict between Catholicism and voodoo. They were just two different ways of viewing the world, viewing the spirits, viewing how to live correctly. Voodoo is not about doing evil. It's not about sticking pins in dolls. It's about how to be in harmony with the earth, the ancestors, the spirits, and your community.
Well, and in your book, you talk about some of the legends that were sort of brought forth and propagated through the years through other writings. Talk about sort of these drunken orgies and speaking in tongues and all of these different things, lots of naked bathing. And yet, as you talk about in your book, really most of that is conjecture and or patently false. And when you peel that away, what you are left with is something in some sense very similar to the Catholic rituals and celebrations. And as you said, really about sort of community and family and worshiping, if you will, the spirits or the deities or the gods. When you peel back some of the sort of fantastic stuff of some of the accountings that you were able to dispute in the book, they're not so very different when you boil it all down.
That's right.
And so I can see, and that was a revelation for me in that you could see how they're in many respects complementary. You're taking the African ancestry and heritage and religion that's really almost a different flavor of kind of the same type of thing. I would like to talk a little bit about gree-gree, because that's a term that's ubiquitous in New Orleans. In fact, there's a brand new restaurant called gree-gree. But this idea of what gree-gree meant for the Africans and what that was.
Well, gree-gree come from Senegal. Actually, I have three gree-gree that my friend Jeff Anderson, who is also a historian that is interested in the same thing I'm interested in, he was traveling in Senegal, and he brought me back three examples of gree-gree. They are little amulets, little packets with symbolic ingredients inside. So in New Orleans, it came to mean a little magical amulet or a protection, something you carried on your body or hung up in your house to protect yourself and keep away evil spirits and evil people. The ones that Jeff brought me, I have hanging up over my bed.
And again, so in some sense, that's not, I grew up Roman Catholic, people won't necessarily love this, but in some sense, I don't see that as very different than people will sort of have something in their home, whether it's a cross or it's a devotion to a particular saint or, right? Very similar again to that.
I mean, Marie had altars in her home. Lots of my Catholic friends have altars in their homes. Think about the St. Joseph's altars.
Right.
Think about all the little rituals that people do. The St. Anne Shrine. Have you ever been to the St.
Yes,
Anne Shrine?
Sure.
There used to be a statue of St. Joseph there, and people would leave house keys as offerings because St. Joseph helps you get a house.
That's right. Even today, you will hear New Orleanians talk about burying statues of St. Joseph
in the
yard of a home they hope to purchase, or in the backyard of someplace in...
My best friends were trying to sell their house over across the lake, and they buried a statue, and they sold it.
Right, so there you go. And she was known... So at some point, and I'm jumping ahead a bit in the story, at some point, Marie Laveau sort of assumes or is assumed to have become this voodoo priestess. And there's a lot of back and forth, and you go through it in your book, in that she would have never referred to herself as that, from what I can tell, in your book, and wasn't referred to in her life quite that way.
I don't know if she would have called herself a voodoo priestess. She was doing what she felt she was meant to do, and she developed a following. She must have been very beautiful, very charismatic. And she was approachable. She wasn't scary. She had members of her congregation who were black and enslaved, who were free people of color, and who were white aristocrats. And a lot of them were women. People would come to her for consultations. People would come to her weekly meetings at her home. And they would come to the big ceremonies on St. John's Eve out at the lake. She was very welcoming. And people are always asking me, well, why did she become so famous? And why her and not somebody else? Well, I think it was for all those reasons. And also, in the later 19th century, actually after she was dead, the very popular New Orleans writer, George Washington Cable, wrote about her, and she became nationally famous. Mm-hmm. And he did actually meet her. He says, I once saw in her extreme old age the venerable voodoo queen, Marie Laveau. I can't quote it exactly, sure. But it's something like that.
Well, and she was well known in the city.
Oh, she was. Some people were afraid of her, but most people loved her.
And it does seem that she did a lot of acts of good, that she was known. Maybe it wasn't what she did all day long, per se, but she would, she helped people get out of jail occasionally. She helped people take in people that had nowhere else to go.
Right. Well, she provided a place for the Indians to stay. There were people who would come in from out in the country. I guess they were Choctaw, to sell their wares at the market, and she would let them camp in her yard. She would visit prisoners who were going to be hung, and she would build altars in their cell. And then the thing I discovered when I was doing the research on her tomb, there are 84 people buried in there. Mm-hmm. Some of them are family members. I think there's 25 family members. Some can be identified as family friends or neighbors. But most of them are people that you never heard of. How was she connected with them? Well, I figured out she was doing an act of charity. It's one of the seven acts of mercy that are required by the Catholic Church, and one of them is bury the dead. So I think, and most of these people that I couldn't figure out who they are, they were kind of marginal people. They were poor. They might have been recent immigrants. Somebody in the family dies. Where are we going to bury this person? Marie says, you can bury them in my tomb.
So we should explain that. And I've actually done an episode of the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast about the St. Louis cemeteries of New Orleans with a wonderful local author, Sally Asher.
Written
a book about the lives of the people. But for people listening and sort of wondering about what you just said, so of course in New Orleans, we for the most part bury people above ground in these vaults that in some sense are like little bitty homes, if you will. Marie Laveau's tomb is a three-crypt vault. But what that means is it's also a very hot, humid climate in New Orleans. So you may think of today where you slide a casket in. But in New Orleans, there's a tradition of a day and a year, or a year and a day, where if you bury someone in a vault, that vault can't be unlocked are unsealed for a year and a day. But at that point, the body is largely broken down. And so what happens is the remains are taken out, in modern day, taken out of a casket, placed in a much smaller receptacle, if you will, and can be pushed down into the bottom, and then you can bury someone else. And so when if you were to come and visit St. Louis No. 1 and Marie Laveau's tomb, again, you would see sort of three tiers, but it can house plenty of people because you can't think of it in terms of a casket that stays in and stays intact forever. And so in her day, again, as you mentioned, Carolyn, that she would often, if someone needed a place to have a proper burial, she would offer her tomb. And that tradition still happens today. I recently did an episode about the Upstairs Lounge, which was a fire of a gay bar, an arson of a gay bar where 32 men and women lost their lives. And there were some people that the families didn't claim the people because this was in the early 70s. And so people that had tombs allowed people to be buried there. And that continues even today. So she was doing, maybe was one of the first to do something that in New Orleans continues today. You offer up your tomb. But that seems very odd to someone that maybe isn't familiar with how people are buried in New Orleans. And so she did do that. You mentioned the Indians. Her property on St. Ann Street, by all accounts, the actual structure was set back a little
right.
bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was some space, not a ton of space, but there was space. And so Native American Indians, she allowed them to sort of stay on the grounds and camp on the grounds of her home in between when they were out selling their wares. And those are just two of like, that was something that really was interesting to me in the book. Of she did do lots of acts of charity or lots of acts of sort of taking care of other members of various communities, particularly those that might have been disenfranchised. We mentioned, and I apologize for jumping all around, you mentioned her property was very close to Congo Square. So today you can visit the site of Congo Square. It's across Rampart Street out of the back of the French Quarter in the Treme. And that was a place, we didn't really talk about it too much, but that was a place where, for the most part, African Americans and slaves were allowed to congregate on Sundays. And it was a, I don't know if safe haven is too strong a term, but it was a place where they could celebrate and dance, and there was a beating of drums, and it was a place of community, and that was very, very close to where she was.
And there was nothing else like that in North America. New Orleans is the only place where they were able to do that on Sundays.
And you have some great accounting of that, great descriptions of people that visited, and that, in fact, in your book you talk about, it was considered a tourist attraction
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
come and see, by accounts, anywhere from 50 to hundreds of people there on Sunday afternoons. And so, again, Native American Indians would have been welcome there, and it was a little bit of a marketplace.
Oh, it was a market, yeah.
So it was a place that again, people who otherwise didn't have any rights could sell and exchange and commune and sing and dance.
And originally it was called the Congo Plains, so it was a bigger area than what's there now.
Right, and now it's surrounded by trees, and in part, again, you also talk, and I'm jumping ahead again in the book, as we got into the pre-Civil War and then certainly post-Civil War and Jim Crow, and one way that governors and mayors could start to curtail that was to plant trees.
Mm-hmm.
So you were physically blocking the space that was at one
time
open.
And they changed the name to Beauregard Square.
Yes, so.
And it was for whites only.
And PGT Beauregard. People familiar with New Orleans will remember the controversy with the statues.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last couple of years, there was a huge statue of PGT Beauregard in front of City Park, not far from the New Orleans Museum of Art. And that's the Beauregard you're referring to. So it was as much a slap in the face as could possibly be for a place that was at one time a gathering place for people who had no other place to gather. But again, I'm sort of jumping all over the place there. You mentioned the celebrations on St. John's Eve. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that and explain to listeners what St. John's Eve was and is and how that played into the voodoo culture and in New Orleans.
Well, it's the feast of St. John the Baptist. It's a Catholic feast day. And all kinds of people celebrated St. John's Eve, the Freemasons for one. And people would go out to the lake. They ran special trains out there. People would go out there to bathe in the lake, to have bonfires, sell gumbo and coffee, shoot off fireworks. So there was all kinds of stuff going on out there. But from what I've been able to figure out, the place where Marie's ceremonies were about where the UNO campus is now. And of course, that was all swampland out there. And so they would celebrate St. John's Eve. That was much bigger than the weekly ceremonies they had at her house. They would have prayers and chanting and singing and dancing and drumming and calling upon the spirits. And then at some point, they would all go and bathe in the lake. You know, that goes back to European tradition of bathing in sacred bodies of water at certain times of the year. And remember, the St. John's Eve is very close to the summer solstice.
Right, just 2 days, June 23rd?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you hear these stories about people rushing into the lake naked. Well, I don't think so. I think they maybe took off their outer clothing. But
and you can see how they could take the vestiges of truth and make a leap. But for listeners maybe not familiar, so a lot of things interesting to me there. The bulk of New Orleans is between the Mississippi River and Lake Pontchartrain. Lake Pontchartrain is an avenue by which you can get into the Gulf of Mexico. Connecting sort of the two more or less is Bayou St. John. So there's a tie there. And in this period of time when we're talking, as we get into the early and then middle and then late 1800s, today, if people are familiar with New Orleans, as you mentioned, the University of New Orleans, and there's an old Spanish fort. You have to look hard now to find the remnants. But in her day, those were resort areas. And so at the end, out by Spanish Fort, was a resort area, and there was another one called Millenburg or Milneyburg, mm-hmm. and then there was a third one at West End.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right, it was a haul to get out there. But as you talk about in the book, there would be extra train cars on the Smoky Mary or extra routes and different ways for people to get out. But it was rural and swampland between the city and then getting out to the lake. But once you were out there, it wasn't uncommon to have, you think about today and all the festivals.
It changed over the years. And I think later in the 19th century, after Marie was dead, it really did become kind of a commercial festival, a kind of a tourist event. It was becoming commercialized then.
Sure. Sure, but you can see, again, the legend being different from the truth of there were big celebrations and festivals, and that they changed and maybe got more commercial over mm-hmm. the years. But they started out as celebrations of a feast day, effectively.
Yeah, yeah. It was an Afro-Catholic celebration.
Sure, and not the, as had been portrayed in some of the news reports or reportings of the time, of these drunken orgies. They were like any celebration. There was food, there was drink, there was, yes, people were bathing, but it wasn't this sort of sexual frenzy, by all accounts, that was sort of part of the legend, if you will.
Well, one of the things that was going on with the newspaper stories as you get after Reconstruction into the 1880s, 1890s, people were using voodoo to stigmatize people of color, especially recently freed slaves, and saying, you know, oh, look how primitive and ignorant these people are. They're doing voodoo, and they aren't capable of voting or holding office or being citizens. Look at what they do. So you get these more and more sensationalized newspaper articles. And there's one, I think it's in about 1894, where they talk about boiling a cat and eating it alive and, oh, just all this baloney.
I did think in reading your book, as you talk about now, you go into some detail about, you know, you got to be mindful of the time and the Civil War and then Jim Crow and post-Reconstruction, and that there was a very definite bent in the reporting to try to do those things you're mm-hmm. talking about. Mm-hmm. And it really helped for me think about, well, how do you get because the reality of Marie Laveau's life was very different than the legend. But then when you sort of think about, well, why the legend was created and, again, these various takes on it, against the context of time and history, it really starts to make more sense that she did lead, by all accounts, this really exceptional life. She did a lot of good, as you've mentioned, for a lot of people. She was spiritual and in two religions, if you will, very devoted. But some of these other things were meant, based on the time, to be derogatory.
Sure.
You know, and to discredit all that work.
Well, the white journalists, especially from some of the newspapers that were very conservative, would never miss a chance to denigrate people of color.
And in many respects, if you look at it through that lens, her life is sort of a reflection of those times, or the reporting or the creation mm-hmm. of the legend or the myth of Marie Laveau.
But it was more in the early 20th century that she began to be portrayed as an evildoer. She really wasn't mentioned in the newspaper all that much during her lifetime, or even shortly after she died, except for the mostly laudatory obituaries. And, you know, she even had an obituary in the New York Times. So she was nationally famous. People respected and loved her. But later on, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, then you get all the what I call booga booga about ooh, voodoo.
Sure. And of course, much like when we were talking in an earlier episode about Madame LaLaurie, there's a whole sort of cottage industry, bigger than a cottage industry in New Orleans, around sort of this sort of dark magic part of...
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Around voodoo. And even in your book, you talk about there was always sort of accountings of, well, did she sort of have two lives in the sense of one being very devoted in terms of religion, and then was there sort of this sham practice of, mm-hmm. of other things there?
Well, there were people who said that if you paid her enough money, she would do, quote, bad work for you. I'd like to think she didn't, but I don't know.
But maybe she did, right? And you also talked about in your book, sort of along those lines, there was sort of an antagonist character at that time, Dr. John, mm-hmm. and who, by all accounts, was sort of a shim-sham, snake oil salesman type of guy.
Well, he was portrayed that way in the newspaper. Now, he was truly an African. He even had the tribal scars on his face. But he's always portrayed as kind of a charlatan. And think about Marie died in 1881. Dr. John, whose name was really Jean Montanet, died in 1885. All the New Orleans newspapers and the New York Times, except for one or two exceptions, wrote very admiring reminiscences and obituaries of her. Dr. John, I mean, there was something about him in the paper, but it wasn't very complimentary. And most of what we know about him was written by Lafcadio Hearn and published in Harper's Weekly magazine, I think.
Well, and it could be, you know, it could be that I'm falling for sort of the same trap that people fell for Marie Laveau. It mm-hmm. could be, if there were more information about him, that we may find that the truth is very different than the legend.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought people listening to this are going, Dr. John.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So Mac Rabenach.
Yeah. He took on that persona back in when the 60s, early 70s. Dr. John, the night tripper.
Right. So Dr. John, the terrific musician in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know that story until I read your book, that that's where he had gotten the stage name.
Well, he wrote a little autobiography called Under a Hoodoo Moon, and he talks a lot about that.
So then one of the other legends that you address in your book, and you sometimes hear the tour guides again today say, well, Marie Laveau was a voodoo queen for 140 years. And some of that sort of maybe gets traced to, was there a Marie Laveau the second?
Oh, that's such a difficult question. I have been agonizing over that question for, what is it, 25 years now. And actually, I'm collaborating with another historian who we want to write an article, you know, try to really pin down, was there a second Marie Laveau, and who was she?
Well, and you talk about, you know, lots of different theories. Mm-hmm. Could there have been, she did have some daughters, so could it have been one of her daughters that assumed the role? It doesn't seem like it from your research.
I don't think so, because the older daughter, Heloise, or sometimes called Eloise, was born in 1827, and that's the date they always give as the birth date of Marie II. But Heloise died either in 1860 or 1862. I actually found some more evidence when I was doing the research on the tomb. I found a burial record for a woman that I'm pretty sure was her in 1860. Her son, when he was trying to be put in possession of her property in the 1880s, said she died in 1862. I never could find a death certificate for her, but I think I might have found a burial record. Anyway, so I don't think it was her. She died too soon.
Sure, because Marie Laveau didn't die until 20 years after that.
Yeah, Marie died in 1881. All right, the other daughter, Philomene, well, maybe. She did live in the house, and she was said to have been very beautiful, but she was interviewed by several newspaper reporters, and she would get very angry if you even brought up voodoo with her. She said, "Oh no, I hate voodoo," and she would be so insulted if you said her mother had been a voodoo priestess. Now, was she faking it or not? At one time I said, no, absolutely it wasn't Philomene. I'm thinking, maybe. I don't know. Or was it somebody else who was calling herself Marie Laveau?
To me, it's just one more part of the story. And, yeah. And I sort of, again, as a New Orleanian, I thought I knew the story of Marie Laveau, and what I knew was the legend of Marie mm-hmm. Laveau. You have a great line right at the end of your book, and I'll read it here. You say, "As a mirror, Marie tells us more about the era from which she is observed than she does about herself." And I think that is really like a neat, listeners should definitely dive into the book. But that to me is really instructive, that we think we know so much about Marie Laveau. And you've certainly uncovered a lot. But perhaps her life is best thought of as a mirror and a reflection of mm-hmm. the times. Mm-hmm. That whole period, which was a big change in U.S. history, but also in New Orleans history. She comes around. She's born right as we're undergoing this huge change with the transition to being bought by the United States.
She was born in 1801, which is another legend. Is you hear 1794, you hear 17 something else, but she was there's a baptismal record.
Sure.
1801.
Well, and in so much of what you and I have talked about, both with this and with Madame Lalaurie.
Lalaurie.
Thank you, Lalaurie, is that there are records in New Orleans. And one thing, two things I did want to hit on before I let you go is, one, that you talk in this book and in your other book so much about the Louisiana Writers Project.
Oh, yes.
And if you could talk for a moment about what that is and what a resource that is.
Well, it's a wonderful resource. That was kind of my key to all of this. The Writers Project was part of the Federal Works Progress Administration or Works Projects Administration. I think it was called both things. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, New Deal. America was in a terrible depression. What are we going to do? We're going to create all these jobs. That's what we ought to be doing now. and he put artists and writers and things like the Civilian Conservation Corps that restored parklands and people who painted murals in post offices. It was just the most wonderful thing. So every state had a writer's project, and they employed out-of-work writers. So Lyle Saxon was the director of the Louisiana Writers Project, and he had always been interested in Marie Laveau. In fact, I think it was Lyle Saxon who first originated the idea of Marie the Second. So here he has this group of about 20 young employees. Well, they weren't all young.
Sure.
Most of them were white. A couple of them were black. And he sent them out into the community to find elderly people who had actually known Marie or her children or her grandchildren. So there are these typed interviews. Now, some of them are at the New Orleans Public Library, and they're in the Robert Talent papers. Robert Talent was using them when he wrote Voodoo in New Orleans, but he was just picking and choosing little bits and stitching it all together and making up stuff. but it was based on the Writers Project. So I started trying to find out, well, where are the original interviews? And nobody knew. They weren't at the Library of Congress where they were supposed to be. Finally, somebody said, they are at Northwestern State University in Natchitoches, because after the whole New Deal ended with the entry into World War II, Lyle Saxon said, I ain't going to give that stuff to the Library of Congress. I'm taking it with me, and I'm going to use it for something in the future. So he took boxes and boxes of these typed interviews with him to Melrose Plantation, which was owned by his friend Cammie Henry. And then he got cancer and he died. And the boxes remained at Melrose Plantation. So years went by. I think it was in the 1970s, some descendants of Cammie Henry found these boxes, and they said, oh, this is important stuff. We're going to give it to the library at the university, Northwestern, which is in Natchitoches. And so that's where they are.
But they were a treasure trove for you and for other researchers.
Yeah. So the wonderful archivist down there, Mary Lynn Wernette, she sent me the finding aid, and then I made a list of the folders that I wanted copied that seemed to pertain to Marie Laveau. And she copied all of them for me for 10 cents a page or something. and just, I guess, year before last, I finally had an opportunity to visit that library. I was down there giving a lecture. So I got to go through the library with Mary Lynn, and we looked at the actual folders.
Well, I just wanted to mention one because of the resource, not only for you, but for other researchers who might hear this. And the Louisiana Writers Project is such a, in both your books that we've talked about, was such a resource and such a way to help, in many cases, disprove myths. You mentioned Robert Talent, and he had access, and you talk about that in your book. He had access and kind of used that access to his own credit, and then ignored it when he wanted to ignore it, it appears. And then the second thing, kind of changing topics as we wrap up, is your book has a wonderful cover. You did it yourself. You did the drawing and the painting. But what's interesting to me about it is that there's no known images of Marie Laveau.
Well, when her daughter, Philomene, was interviewed by a reporter, and she said, my mother never sat for an artist or a photographer, and there are no pictures of her. And she, I think she said that painting that's in the Cabildo is not her.
But you have this wonderful representation.
Well, that's based on the alleged portrait that's in the Cabildo.
That's all you can go with, right? But it's a beautiful work of art, and I was privileged to be able to come visit you and get to see your original. And I just want to thank you so much for your time, but also for helping New Orleanians and people interested in New Orleans learn about Marie Laveau and separating the woman from the legend and the myth. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll put links to Carolyn's books at our website over at beyondbourbonst.com. We've really only just kind of skimmed the surface. I would encourage if you want to learn more about the life of Marie Laveau and also about the other works, we'll put it all there. You can find our podcast anywhere you get podcasts. And please subscribe so that you can follow them. We publish bi-weekly. And until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.